If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that I'm a big fan of connecting with locals when you're traveling someplace. If you're just going to be inside the tour bus, then you might as well stay home. The best parts of travel for me are when you get out into the marketplace or into the cafe where you meet the locals and have a chance to interact. If you're also looking to experience this, then check out Explore Worldwide, whose local tour leaders will get you off the beaten track and into the heart of the adventure, helping you get past being a tourist, experiencing local culture, and finding places you would not find by yourself. And isn't that what travel is all about? If you're thinking about your next adventure, head to exploreworldwide.com to find out more.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 682. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about chimpanzees and gorillas and a volcano with a lake of burning lava as we go to Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Virunga. I'd like to welcome to the show Neil from Ireland, who's come to talk to us not about Ireland, but about Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
Now, we're talking to an Irishman about an African country. What is your connection with Virunga National Park and with the DRC?
I came across Virunga, maybe like a lot of people, scrolling through Netflix. I came across the Virunga documentary, which was Oscar nominated a couple of years back. People might have come across it. And when I watched it and I saw the conservation work being done there, I kind of fell in love, and my fiance as well. And ever since, we've been kind of keeping tabs on the park, keeping tabs on the charity and the work they're doing, and kind of daydreaming about coming here someday. And fortunately, a couple of months ago, we got to live it out and spend 8 days in the park.
Excellent. And if we wanted to put it on a map, we're in the DRC, so we're in the western half of the southern part of Africa. And where are we within the Democratic Republic of Congo?
Virunga National Park is right on the eastern edge of the DRC. And if you were to put it on a map, you're pretty much in the exact heart of Africa. So there's a very large city, Goma, which is about 1 million people. And the park runs north from there along the border with Rwanda and Uganda.
Excellent. And why should someone go to Virunga National Park?
Okay, so I think there's kind of three main reasons people generally go to Virunga. I suppose the first is the picture postcard one. It's near a Gongo volcano. So for those of you who don't know, it's one of the only active lava lakes on Earth. So it's a very, very unique thing. I think there's only 7 in the whole globe. So that's a really, really big attraction. The second part of it is mountain gorillas. So again, there's only 3 places on Earth you can see mountain gorillas. Virunga National Park is one of those. And then the final one I'd say is Virunga is one of the oldest and the greatest national parks on Earth and one of the world's great conservation projects. And you can visit it with almost no other tourists. So it's really a chance to see a great African national park pretty much to yourself.
Okay. And when you say there are only a couple other places you can see mountain gorillas, you happen to be a stone's throw from them when you're in Virunga National Park.
Absolutely. So the mountain gorillas basically only live in the Virunga Mountains. Mm-hmm. And those mountains kind of straddle the Rwandan, Ugandan, and DRC border. So within an hour, you're in, basically it's the same gorillas, and they actually do mm-hmm. pass back and forth across the border. And Virunga is just one of those three locations. But there's some differences in terms of price and the size of the groups you'll be with. So I can talk a little bit about that when we talk about the gorillas later on.
Okay. But really in that area is why I wanted to make sure that people understood is where when we're all the way over there to the east, that means we're really just across the border from Uganda. Excellent. Absolutely. What kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
Perfect. So I know generally on your podcast, you kind of aim for kind of a week itinerary. Mm-hmm. And
with Virunga, with some flexibility when we're going as far as Africa.
Absolutely. And I guess a lot of your guests, if they go to Africa, they're likely to maybe tag this onto maybe a wider trip or a wider safari. Mm-hmm. So Virunga is actually very flexible. So anything between kind of 2 days to 8 days, you're going to see quite a lot. And there's kind of four main sites within the park. And depending on your interests and preferences, you can mix and match them. So if you really only want to see the volcano, you can be in and out in 48 hours. If you want to do everything, about 8 days. And what we did was we spent quite a lot of time there. We were there kind of 9-10 days. So we did everything and in quite a bit of detail. And we can talk you through that itinerary, but you can absolutely slice and dice it to fit your own timescale.
Excellent. And where should we start?
Anyone visiting Virunga is going to be coming in through the large city of Goma. Now, Goma is kind of an interesting place, for want of a better word. So it's a city of 1 million people mm-hmm. with a huge number of those being UN peacekeepers and NGOs. It's always been a part of the world that's a little bit chaotic. Mm-hmm. And I found when I was looking it up, and a lot of your listeners might find it interesting, is if you go on Google Earth, there's two kind of twin cities. Most people will come in from Rwanda, so you'll fly into Kigali, which is only about a 2 to 3 hour drive into the border to crossing. And there's a town of Gisenyi in Rwanda, which is more or less twinned with Goma. They run right into each other. There's no real clear border between them. Except if you look on Google Earth, you can... Even if there was no border on the map, you could absolutely tell the difference between Rwanda and the DRC. On one side of the map, there's these beautiful houses, lovely straight roads, gardens, greenery. And on the other side, there is chaos. Absolute and utter chaos.
And to be clear, you're taking us to the chaotic side.
Absolutely. But a little chaos in life is good. So Goma is an unusual place. I think the feeling I got there was it's kind of Pompeii in waiting. So the first thing that will really strike you when you get into Goma is the volcano near Agongo frames your entire view. So you look out over the city, and in the very near distance is a near Agongo. And it tends to give out a lot of clouds of smoke pretty much all day round. And that's not a fake sign. The volcano is very much active, and it erupted in 2002 was the most recent one. And it did flow through the city and cause quite a bit of damage. And you'll still see when you drive through the city, places where, say, there was a two-story house. And now the entrance is on the first floor because the whole ground floor is now basically solidified lava.
Huh.
It's an unusual spot. It's not one that I suspect most visitors spend any great time in. So, like for us, we got to the border. And we met our guide who took us pretty much through Goma without stopping. So we drove through the city. It's perfectly safe during the day, but I think the most interesting part of the city is just to see it. I think for anyone whose experience either hasn't been in Africa or has experienced maybe more, you know, the safari lodges and that kind of mm-hmm. side of it, it is a good introduction to maybe some of the more real day-to-day experiences on the ground. It would awaken your senses, for better or worse, but it's a very interesting place to pass through.
And you mentioned meeting your guide. How did you find a guide for this trip?
Despite it being quite a complicated part of the world, this was probably one of the easiest trips I've ever taken. Hmm. So to go to Virunga National Park, because of the security in the region, they organize everything centrally. So your point of contact will always be the national park. And they have a specific tourist department that looks after all the logistics. I suppose one of the things that concerned me day one was, well, there's a land border that I have to cross in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not always a reassuring thing to be doing. So actually, when I was on the ground, I found it wonderful was when you cross the border into the DRC, there's actually a very, very modern building that was actually funded by Howard Buffett. I think it's one of the areas he does a lot of charitable work. So he actually built a modern...
Do you mean Warren Buffett?
Warren Buffett's brother.
Warren Buffett's brother, okay.
Yes. So I think he's actually a partner in the business, and he's also equally as successful. And he's actually hugely involved in both Goma and the national park itself. And has done amazing work. And actually, when you go around the area, you'll see lots of signs bearing his names where his foundation has done great work. So the actual border crossing itself is fantastic. It's like a modern kind of airport type building. And one of the conditions of this very fancy building being built was that Virunga National Park were actually given an office inside in the border patrol area. So when you go in, you don't meet guards, you don't meet people checking your passport. You actually meet your tourist guide, who will take your passport, go away behind the scenes and organize everything for you while you sit comfortably in their tourist office. So for anyone who's nervous about crossing borders in Africa or anything like that, this is absolutely the easiest thing in the world. It's not something to be concerned about at all.
Just one correction. I looked up and Howard Buffett is Warren Buffett's son rather than...
Okay, perfect. So most people are going to cross through the land border. And you're going to meet the representatives of Virunga National Park there, and they can take you directly into their vehicles, which will transfer you to the park. So you don't need to worry about any transportation or any of the logistics.
Okay.
So once that's done, you leave Goma. And to be honest, there's no particular reason to spend much time there. There are some tourist operators that do guided tours of the city from people who've done it and people we met during the park. Not a whole lot to see. Unless you're very much into kind of getting on the ground in these kind of places, that's something you can kind of comfortably skip over. So when you leave the park, your very first almost occasion, you have about a kind of 45 minutes to an hour drive. You can go to Nyiragongo Volcano and kind of the base camp for that. And Nyiragongo is really the poster child for the park. It's by far the most popular tourist attraction. So I would say nearly every guest goes there, and a lot of guests will go only to the volcano. So a lot of people who've done gorillas in either Uganda or Rwanda will maybe very briefly for maybe 48 hours travel across the border to see this very unique feature. I don't have a blog myself, but I do put reviews up on TripAdvisor, and I found this one was actually very popular, and I got a lot of questions. I think mainly because there's not a lot of information online about it and what the trek of the volcano entails. And a lot of people are very nervous, myself included, that they won't make it to the top. I suppose just to give people a bit of background on what the hike is like and what you'll see, the hike itself starts at about 2,000 meters and you go up 1,500 meters in five stages over about 5 or 6 hours. So it's a relatively difficult climb in that you go up quite a lot of elevation and the footing isn't the best. There's lots of parts where you have kind of small slippery stones.
So scree, the kind of things that you take two steps forward and you slide one step back, that sort of thing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Except the only unique thing about this scree is that it's actually lava. So from the 2002 eruption, there's actually different stages on the side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the places where the lava kind of settled more kind of uniformly, it's almost like a footpath. It's a wonderful surface. And then there are parts where the guides were saying the lava kind of cooled at different rates. And because of the friction, you got an awful lot of very kind of small scree-like stones.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as you said, you have to focus very carefully on your footing. And because actually the rock is lava, it is actually very sharp. You have to be very, very careful with it. But I suppose I've got a lot of people asking, like some people were saying, we've done Everest Base Camp. Will we be able to do it? Absolutely. You don't need anywhere near that level of fitness first. I have done nothing more strenuous than walking for about 10 years. And I was comfortable enough doing it. So I think anyone with mild fitness will be fine. The real challenge, and what I would warn people about, is I think you would need to have kind of be comfortable that your footing is good and that you kind of sturdy footing and you're comfortable with, mm-hmm. I suppose, about 5 to 6 hours uphill and on quite uneven ground and patches. In terms of the actual hike itself, you start off at the rainforest level. And so that's all very easy, bar the fact that it's quite warm. So if you've dressed for the mountaintop, it can be a little bit uncomfortable. So one of the first things everyone gets told is dress in layers, and that's absolutely vital. As you move up, you start to hit the lava fields. And again, that is a mixed bag. There are some lovely stretches that are like a footpath. Mm-hmm. There are some areas where you're going to have to mind your footing and pay huge attention. The bit that most people get nervous about, and in reality isn't so bad, is the very last stage. So the fifth stage, you get to a hut and you get a little rest and a break. And then you have almost not far off a kind of a vertical last couple of 100 meters. Now, you will spend a little bit of time at that with your kind of hands and knees and a bit of scrambling. But it goes very quickly. It doesn't require mountaineering skill or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And the porters are very good. So again, every group that goes up has porters with them and guides. And they're very hands-on. And the guys could do this in their sleep. So there's guys carrying 6 different bags and wearing runners, and they were holding up and carrying me up the mountain as if I was nothing. So it's very doable.
Okay.
And some people will be concerned about altitude. Again, this is much lower than Kilimanjaro. So while it's quite high, the likelihood of actually suffering anything from altitude is very, very low. So I wouldn't worry about that.
Well, I'm seeing that the lava lake is around 3,250 meters or 10,000 feet. So it's not great in terms of breathability, but you know, you can get higher than that just going over the Rocky Mountains on a road. So you're not nearly as high up as you would be at Everest or K2 or someplace like that. Yeah,
exactly. And while you might feel it a little bit, mm-hmm. it's not a very strenuous climb. It is an up in one day and down the next morning type of climb. So there's no great worries about acclimatization or anything like that. It's mm-hmm. not at the severe altitude sickness kind of area.
I wouldn't think so. No, I did hiking just last week at 9,000 feet, and I know that the air is thinner. You're going to have to go slower, but it's not like you worry about, are you going to make it from altitude sickness or something?
So I suppose that's the process of getting up there. I suppose the more interesting bit is, why would you do it? Mm-hmm. And that is the wonderful bit. So at the top of the volcano, there's a set of huts, so kind of A-frame huts, so you can stay up there overnight, and you are right on the lip of an active volcano. And
you know, I don't know that you've answered the why would you do it part yet for some people.
Despite what movies might tell you, and villains in movies always seem to have lava lakes kind of to hand very easily. In reality, there's not a lot of them going around. So mm-hmm. I think there's about 7 on the entire planet. One or two of them are in Antarctica. And I think another 2 are in Vanuatu. So if you want to visit them, you're in fairly limited options. And a lot of them are very difficult and expensive to get to. Or maybe they're not guaranteed sightings. If you go to the top of Nyiragongo, you are almost certain, I would say 99.9% certain, to see a proper active lava lake with all the bells and whistles that you kind of imagine from the movies. And especially as kind of night falls and it gets dark, looking into the volcano is really, I suppose, it's something very primeval. When mm-hmm. you see the lava cracking and the noise it makes, it is really like the earth kind of splitting apart. It's something incredibly unique to see. And for anyone out there who finds that kind of appealing, it's really worth the hike. And it makes all the pain of scrambling well worth it.
Well, and if you're interested in some of those other spots that Neil is talking about, we've done episodes on 2 of them, one on Vanuatu and one on Ethiopia, including the Danakil Depression, which is where you'll find that lava elsewhere in Africa.
I suppose in terms of the comfort on top, so you're going to spend a lot of time looking at the volcano mm-hmm. and just staring into the abyss, but it's actually quite a comfortable...
ButcherBox is sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler, and I just got my first ButcherBox. I've got packed with dry ice came 4 packets of ground beef, 3 packets of chicken breasts,
two steaks, some pork ribs, and some sirloin tips. Now, I've got a great recipe for what to do with the chicken. At least one of those packets of chicken is going to become Greek chicken and rice. And if you go to chris2x.com, I've got a recipe there that's an Instant Pot recipe. But I'm not good with steak, and so I'm going to take advantage of the fact that ButcherBox has recipes on their site at butcherbox.com to learn some great recipes to do with those steaks. You can have ButcherBox deliver meat to your doorstep. Free shipping is always curated to custom box plans. You can easily find high-quality meat and seafood you can trust. 100% grass beef, free-range organic chicken, pork-raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised, no antibiotics or added hormones. I also like the fact that I could recycle all the box and shipping material that they sent. Sign up at butcherbox.com/traveler and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional 20% off. Choose salmon, chicken, breast, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/traveler. If you got recipes for ribs or steaks, send them my way as I send my thanks to ButcherBox.com for sponsoring this episode of Amateur Traveler.
Set up on top of the volcano. So the porters cook dinner. So you get a proper warm dinner provided to you. The A-frame huts, while not, I would say, overly comfortable, are very serviceable. Mm-hmm. They keep the rain out. They keep the cold out. There's a mattress provided, sleeping bags, all that kind of stuff. So you're not hauling all this gear across continents if you're flying. It's all provided on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
All things considered, while you're not going to have the best night's sleep, you will get by perfectly fine. It's not really slumming it in the... some people, when they think, I think when a lot of my friends heard I was going to the DRC, I think they had this vision of me in a little tent by the side of a road. It's a lot better than that. It's a lot more comfortable than that.
And the air quality would be the one thing that I would be wondering about, because obviously you're in a cloud of noxious gases much of the time.
Yeah, so we didn't find it ourselves. So we've been to the Danakil Depression before, okay. And I know the fumes there cause a little bit of bother, and it was quite pungent at times. but here, actually, because you're quite a long way up, so you have a very good view of the lava lake. But it's kind of because you're elevated on the crater rim. Okay. It's quite dispersed. So you actually don't suffer too much from it. And actually, we didn't have any issues at all.
Okay. And the Danakil Depression is exactly what I was thinking about, because I have a friend who went there and their tour guide did not bring gas masks and noticed that one of the other tour guides did and thought it seemed like a really good idea. So, but that does make sense what you're saying. You're further up and you get crosswinds and things like that. Okay.
Absolutely. And I suppose the one thing I would mention is if someone is going to Virunga and the Nyiragongo volcano is the high point and the real target of your trip,
mm-hmm.
I would suggest that you try and avoid the rainy seasons.
Okay.
Because every afternoon, the Congo is one of the biggest rainforests on Earth.
Right.
And that means a lot of rain in the afternoons. And if you get heavy cloud cover, which we did actually at times when we were going up, it limits the amount of time you get to spend watching the volcano. Now, again, I've never heard of anyone going up and not seeing it, but there's a big difference between getting 30 minutes of visibility and unlimited time. So I think if the volcano is your be-all and end-all, I think definitely avoid the rainy seasons, which are March to kind of mid-May is the big rainy season.
Okay.
And then there's a smaller one between September and November.
Okay.
Excellent. So that's the kind of volcano, and that's the big tourist attraction. The second thing people go to Virunga for, and you'll see it from the park logo, is gorillas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of, again, only three places on Earth you can see them. It's a very accessible location, barring the fact that it's in the DRC. The landscape is quite good in that I know from some of the places you can see it, I think Uganda particularly, I've heard the land and the density of the forest can be quite tricky.
Well, and it's a bit of a trek, depending on where you're going. And it's getting more and more expensive are the two things that I know about Uganda and Rwanda. And I don't really know how that compares with DRC.
Firstly, the biggest indicator of a difference is the price.
Okay.
So in terms of kind of order of cost, if you want to go to Gorillas and you have a limited budget, the DRC is definitely your best option. So you can go to see Gorillas in the rainy season in the DRC for $200. $200 is the permit for 1 hour.
Okay.
So it doesn't sound cheap, but when you compare it to the alternative, so in the dry season, the DRC, it's $400. Mm-hmm. Once you get to Uganda, I think you're talking $500 all year round. And I think Rwanda is over $1,000, but that fluctuates depending on when you ask them. So I think they went up to about $1,500 for a while, and then I think the tourist numbers fell away. So that is in flux, but it's significantly more expensive than the DRC.
Okay.
So I think if you're on a more backpackery budget, or if you're kind of doing a bigger trip to Africa and you want to kind of manage the costs of this piece, a trip to the DRC in the rainy season for Gorillas is actually quite a good option, because I know I've warned people off going to see the volcano in rainy season because you're out in the volcano, you're exposed, your visibility isn't great. Gorillas are quite different because you get very, very up close and personal with them. Mm-hmm. Because you're in the rainforest and you're kind of undercover for actually a lot of the walk. And because a lot of the rain tends to fall in the afternoon, so it tends to be very cyclical. You have nice warm mornings, and then from kind of 2-3 o'clock onwards, you get really, really heavy rainstorms. Mm-hmm. You'll actually have gone to the gorillas, seen them. If it rains, it's not a huge imposition, and you can enjoy them. And actually, if you're a photographer, other than keeping your camera dry, which can be a challenge, you get great photos because obviously with the light refracting on the leaves and the raindrops and on the animals themselves, you get some really spectacular pictures.
Well, and for those who haven't done it, describe how it take much effort it takes to get to see the particular group that you're seeing and how close you're getting and what that was like.
In terms of Virunga, there's kind of two main sectors. There's the gorilla sector, and there's actually gorillas in the volcano sector as well. And in both of those, when you sign up, there's a lot of different families that have been domesticated. So I think there's about 10 domesticated families of gorillas. Well, domesticated is the wrong word.
Domesticated, habituated.
Habituated is probably, that's a slightly more accurate description of it. Yeah,
still wild animals, but used to people being around.
Absolutely. So when you're going to trek to them, there's actually a kind of a almost like a school board that shows the family names, the number of adults, kids, babies. And depending on the groups, the size of the group that are going trekking out to see the gorillas and the fitness of the individual groups, they can actually tailor it to the people.
Okay.
And I suppose that's one of the beauties of doing Virunga.
What other groups are going to? Because you've only got so many gorillas and they're not going to send everybody to the same group.
Correct. So there's very small groups, so they wouldn't send any more than, I think it's 8 people.
And it's something like 8 people per day per family group, something in that range is what you're talking about.
That's right. So each family only gets one visit a day. The beauty of the DRC really, though, is because the tourist numbers are so much smaller, like I say, we did 2 visits to gorillas on consecutive days. We were the only 2 people in the group both days. And again, that's why you can have flexibility about kind of more picking families that are suitable to you and treks that are maybe shorter if you're not comfortable with longer hikes. There's flexibility because there's less tourists, and then the guides are able to personalize it a little bit more for you. So the accessibility in the DRC is pretty good. Like say the 2 gorilla families we visited involved about an hour hike each time, but to describe it as a hike is probably overselling it. One of the days particularly, it was pretty much a flat walk for the whole hour. Through basically farms and kind of fields up until the edge of the park. And then we had a very, very gentle incline for maybe 10, 15 minutes from the border of the forest into the family. So again, for people who are concerned about maybe longer hikes or more difficult hikes or undergrowth, the DRC and the options in Virunga are a little bit more accessible, I think, from what I've heard, than some of the options, particularly in Uganda, where I think the undergrowth is a bit more dense and a bit tougher underfoot. And again, because there's less tourists, I think you have a little bit more scope for more helping hands. And again, there's more guides per person. So you can, if you need help, people are there to help you out.
Okay, interesting. And then in terms of how close you get?
Again, I think when we were in the briefing, they said to keep maybe kind of 6 or 7 meters away. Now, in reality, when you're on the ground, the gorillas do not observe those rules very often.
The rules are for you, not for the gorillas.
Absolutely. So while you're very good and you have your they always put on kind of a surgeon's mask. So again, to protect the gorillas because they're so similar to us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think they share something 90% plus of the same genetic code as humans. Mm-hmm. They obviously catch our diseases. So they just, again, you wear a little surgery mask only when you're on site. So only when you're within a couple of meters of the gorillas. They are very comfortable with people around. So you will get very, very close to them. So in terms of anyone worrying about bringing big lenses or do you have to bring your big safari camera? Absolutely not. I brought mine the first day and I actually couldn't get a picture of the gorillas on camera.
Could you move back a little, please?
I physically could not get them into the shot. So that's how close you get. So, and it's a wonderful thing to maybe, for those of people who can afford it and or who have the time, I would highly recommend doing two visits on consecutive days because it's one of the few times, A, you'll ever get to see them. Mm-hmm. And the families are quite different. So we would have visited the Humba family of gorillas on the first day, which was kind of 10 gorillas. Their big thing was that they had a brand new newborn child. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty spectacular. And I suppose, as stories go, the guard at the time when they spotted it told us it was the first time that anyone had ever seen it. So it was a brand new child that they weren't even aware of. And I suppose being a cynical person, I kind of assume they say that to everyone. but I was tracking the Twitter feed of the park later on. And it turns out that was actually true. So I'm not sure they're going to name it after me, but we can claim to be the first people to see the newborn. So it was very, very exciting.
Well, and you do have an odder spelling of Neil, so that's going to be complicated if they do. So
absolutely. And when they explained to me that a lot of the gorillas are named after, say, rangers who have fallen in protecting the park and stuff like that, I didn't quite feel that my achievements measured up to that.
That seems more appropriate.
Absolutely. And then I suppose the reason to see other groups then is, say, some of the other groups would have, while they wouldn't have newborns, they would have lots of ones in the kind of 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old range. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're going to see gorillas, they are absolutely worth asking the guides to bring you to a family with kids in that range because they're incredibly active. Mm-hmm. And complete messers, and they are up and down trees, throwing each other off, coming and investigating the human beings and see what is the story with them. It's nice to see them. They're like little children, and it's definitely worth doing. I suppose the next big thing that a lot of people will do is the National Park Headquarters. Mm-hmm. So Virunga National Park Headquarters, well, it sounds like an administrative area, and it technically is. So that's where all the park staff, the rangers and all the monitoring teams are based. There's also an awful lot of activities there for a tourist. The first one, and the one that a lot of people who've watched maybe the Virunga documentary will be familiar with, is there's the world's only mountain gorilla orphanage is there. So anyone who's ever seen a gorilla in a zoo, that is not going to be a mountain gorilla. They do not really take well to captivity. They've never managed to survive in it. Mm-hmm. So in zoos around the world, there just are not mountain gorillas. The orphanage here is for a number of gorillas whose parents were killed in incidents in the past, maybe 15, 20 years ago. And they've been kept here and brought up by a very small group of rangers who look after them day in, day out. And they featured very prominently in the documentary. And there's a guy, Andre, who looks after the gorillas almost like they're his own kids. And I think if anyone is listening to this and has seen the documentary, they'll probably be wondering whether you get to meet him. And you can. Now, I personally didn't. He was actually on a holiday at the time back home to his second family. But for most visitors, you actually get to meet him. And he's a little mini celebrity in the world. And I suppose the other thing people might have come across and might have been aware of the Gorilla Orphanage is, if you remember the selfie picture from last year. Yeah. That went viral of a guy with a gorilla kind of doing a pose behind him. That's actually from the orphanage. So that's one of the guys. So that's the guy we met that was showing us around the orphanage. And again, it was not posed. It was absolutely natural, messing around. They didn't quite realize quite how viral it would go. But that you can see the gorillas and you can see the guys who were part of that.
Now, we didn't mention how big the park is. It's like 100 miles long or something on that order.
I think it's about 8,000 square kilometers altogether. It's pretty long and narrow. So I think about 300 kilometers north to south.
Yeah, kind of hugging the border with Uganda. And so how far are one stop to, as you talked about the gorillas and the volcano and the orphanage, are those miles and miles away or right near each other?
The volcano, you're talking about kind of an hour maybe from the border to the volcano.
Okay.
The gorillas, if you go in the volcano sector, gorillas are pretty much there as well. So you don't have much traveling. You can go to the gorilla sector volcanoes, which is about maybe 45 minutes on further into the park. And then from there, you're talking another maybe 25 minutes to the headquarters.
That's all fairly close then.
It's not too bad. Now, the roads are, again,
I was talking miles, you were talking hours, and you're right, that is the more appropriate unit of measure that we should use, I suspect. Yeah.
It's an interesting drive. You will get your back shaken back into place, but it's an interesting drive.
Okay.
Once you're in the headquarters, then the orphanage and all the other activities are all kind of 5-10 minute walks, so they're all in kind of the compound, I guess, of the headquarters. So the orphanage is kind of the big attraction. There's also a possibility of doing chimpanzee tracking. So it's not something that's very well developed there yet. They're kind of still in the process of habituating their families. But again, because there are so few tourists, there are actually opportunities. If you ask them, they will bring you out chimpanzee tracking. So there is an extra fee for that. But it's, again, something that if you're interested in primates, and again, you're kind of tagging this on to your African adventure, there is a chance to go and see chimpanzees and gorillas here.
Okay.
So after the chimpanzee trekking, a lot of people then will go to visit the Widow's Workshop, which is a business. It's run by the wives of rangers who've been killed in service. So we might talk about it a little bit later, but the park is, for all its wonderful side, there is difficulties there.
It is on my list to talk about, yes.
So for the rangers, and being a ranger in the national park is quite a dangerous activity. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, many have been killed over the years. So in terms of the wives of those rangers, the park runs this workshop where they produce luggage tags and toys and various kind of cloth products.
Okay.
And they sell them to tourists, and they actually sell them abroad to shops in Europe and in America. Huh.
Now, in most national parks in Africa, the danger to rangers comes from poachers. Now, I know DRC has had some other issues over the years, which we're going to get to in a bit, including wars. Is that the same problem here, though, predominantly?
It is. So there's an element of poaching, particularly less so in terms of animals, and more so in terms of either bushmeat or in terms of accessing things like charcoal and accessing the resources within the park.
Okay.
And then there's also an element from kind of historic conflicts, particularly in Rwanda and in Uganda, that have seeped across the border. Now, it's probably worth mentioning at this stage, though, is that because the park is so long and narrow, and because the roads are so terrible, the distances on a map, if you were to look at it as an American or as a European, are probably a lot further than you might think. So say issues that are arising in the central sector of the park or the northern sector of the park, while not maybe that far away in pure kilometer terms, is kind of almost a lifetime away in terms of actual interaction between the people on the ground. Maybe just to kind of wrap up on the headquarters part. Again, the accommodation there is quite luxurious. So there's only one option in terms of staying in the headquarters. And that's quite expensive. So I suppose for a lot of guests, I would say it's not a vital addition to your trip. So I think if you're on a budget, the volcano and the gorilla trekking can be done much cheaper, and you can have a perfectly wonderful holiday like that.
Okay.
But if you want a little bit of luxury, a little bit of relaxation in terms of hot water and really, really quality food and things like that, it is a lovely little add-on to your trip in terms of kind of giving you a little bit of a break from the hiking and getting to rest your feet.
Okay.
And I suppose one of the wonderful things about the headquarters is because you're actually there, there's a huge community of the actual park workers around. And so in the afternoon around the bar, you'll get a lot of them having their kind of afternoon drinks. So you can strike up conversation with the guys who've been at the forefront of conservation in Africa and in loads of parks around the area for 20, 30 years. And you can hear their life stories and the things they've come across. And I think actually that was one of the highlights of our trip. Absolutely amazing characters. We met one guy who had been living in Eastern Africa for 30 years, looked a bit like Kurt Russell, flies planes, has been kind of out digging toilets on remote islands and helping the community. And you just meet the most spectacular people who make you feel very insecure about what you've achieved in your own life. But it's it was really special. Okay. So that's the headquarters. And again, well worth visiting, but not an absolute necessity. And I suppose the final kind of fourth site that a lot of people would do at the moment, which is kind of a natural add-on to the volcano particularly, is the island of Chigueira. It's a kind of it's a unique thing because it's kind of separated and removed from the park itself. So all the itinerary so far you've spent in the park and within the confines of kind of rainforest. Mm-hmm. This then you head back towards Goma again and out down to Lake Kivu, which is one of the great lakes in Central Africa. Mm-hmm. And the park just happens historically to own this small uninhabited island on the lake. It's actually the remains of a former volcano. So if you Google it and have a look, it's actually a very strangely kind of crescent-shaped island. Mm-hmm. And that's because there was a volcano there at one stage, which has since got submerged, and you're actually sitting on the lip of it.
Okay.
The island is mainly used as kind of a relaxation after near a Gungo. So again, after hiking up all day, sleeping on the top of it, you come down, you just want a shower, you want a nice bed, you want beer, Wi-Fi. So that's kind of what the island mainly offers. There's a chance to go kayaking on the lake. There's kayaks there. There's a lot of otters and bird life. So it's one of those areas where you can just kind of chill and I think maybe relax and tell your folks back at home that you've made it through the DRC and you're still alive.
Well, and let's talk about that a little bit. Actually, before we say that, we should also mention that the whole park that you're talking about, and you haven't gone into everything, for instance, all the different animals that you can see in the park, or even just the range of geography. You know, you talked about jungles, you talked about volcanoes, there's snow-capped peaks, there's a lake. There's a lot of variety in that 100 miles or so we're talking about, and it is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. But as you said, when you told people you were going to go, they probably told you you're going to die.
Absolutely. So to focus on the good, you're absolutely right. It's a UNESCO site. It's actually the second oldest national park in the entire world. And it's
really?
actually it owes its creation to Yellowstone. So there's an American influence there too. Mm-hmm. The Americans obviously came up with Yellowstone. And that was, I think, the first in the entire world. Mm-hmm. And when King Albert of Belgium went to visit the US in the early 1900s, they took him out there to see it and show it off. And that always stuck with him and the Belgian party that were traveling. And so a couple of years later, after they came back, they kind of went searching for, I suppose, what was the equivalent in the Belgian sphere of influence where they could do something similar. And they settled on this rather spectacular piece of land right on the Congolese, Rwanda, and Uganda border. So it's the second oldest in the world. And as you said, it covers almost every type of landscape imaginable. So I suppose the itinerary I've talked about now is what's available to current visitors. But at different stages and depending on the security situation, the park itself actually has a lot of other things to offer. So someone listening to this in a year's time will hopefully be able to actually do a proper traditional safari in the park. Mm-hmm. So the central sector is actually more like a savanna. Mm-hmm. So you would have your traditional lions, leopards, elephants, buffaloes, hippopotamus. So that is there and it is open depending on the situation. And I suppose that depending on the situation probably rounds me back to the point you made about people being slightly concerned. So right. For anyone who is thinking of going to Virunga, I think it is absolutely worth knowing this is not a Disneyland, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There are some fairly significant issues, both historically and at present, that you need to be aware of. So the first, in terms of if you were to Google the area, is the Ebola epidemic is probably the first thing that's going to pop up.
Right, sure.
And I suppose I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to give anyone any very specific advice on that. But I suppose just to maybe give people a sense of how I got comfortable going and how my fiance and I were happy to visit. I suppose, first of all, it kind of comes back to distance again. If you actually look on the map, it doesn't look all that far. The main outbreak is around a place called Bini. In reality, that is, for most locals, like being on the moon. So when you're on the ground, there's not a lot of people who will own cars. Almost no one will own cars. Very few will even have motorbikes. A lot of locals rely on these traditional wooden scooters, for want of a better word, unmotorized. So people don't really travel beyond their village. So someone who is an outbreak that is 150 kilometers away is not like 150 kilometers in Europe or America. So the chance of you actually coming into contact with anyone is quite remote. I suppose the second part of it was, I suppose Ebola, despite it's obviously a very high profile because it's a very, very serious illness and it's a very, very high fatality rate. At the same time, transmitted is really by kind of hands-on contact. So it's a huge risk for families of people who are affected, priests who are dealing with that, doctors and nurses. It's not really likely to affect a tourist. It's just not something that you're going to be getting involved in.
Right. It doesn't mean that you ought to look for places with Ebola outbreaks for your next vacation. But
absolutely. So look, it's something that you should have to take very seriously and be, I think, do your own research and talk to people about it. But again, it is quite a long way from the part of the park that's open to tourists. And it is, touch wood, in remission at the moment. And so it seems to be that it's dying down. So actually a lot of, hopefully by the time a lot of people listen to this, it will actually have kind of petered out and gone away.
Well, and we had some very good news just within the last week. There was an announcement that there was a new series of drugs that seemed to be effective in treating Ebola. So one would hope that the mortality rate for this disease is going to drop because it sounds like they are having some progress with it. Again, something you still take seriously. And that's absolutely one of the two issues that we've had in the area.
Absolutely. One of many. So then the other one that people will come across is the security concerns.
Right.
So the park itself is in the DRC. And mm-hmm. the DRC as a country is a little bit more of a concept than a fully functioning country in the traditional sense.
Right.
If you look at a map, it's absolutely enormous. It's almost impossible to govern from the capital city on the other side of the country to regions in the east. And unfortunately for them, while most people want to be in very rich areas with loads of minerals and gold and oil and diamonds, for this region that has been a bit of a curse. And it has traditionally brought a lot of conflict to the area. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of armed groups now, particularly in the north of the park. So where the tourists are currently is, I think, as a kind of rule of thumb, you can say the further north you go and the further away you go from the tourist areas, the riskier it becomes. But there is absolutely a legacy of challenges in the area that can flare up. Now, the park itself has the rangers who are completely in charge of the travel and transportation within the park. So you will have an armed escort at any times when you're traveling between locations. They also are linked in with the army and they are monitoring the situation. So they have very, very talented and experienced people in the area who quite simply shut down tourism if there is a concern. But having said all that, as you've said about Ebola, for a lot of people out there, you might just not want to go to somewhere where this is a conversation in the first instance. Mm-hmm. So for people who are interested and who are willing to take the risk that goes with it, this is spectacular and you get to see it again with much reduced tourist numbers. But to be realistic, there are reasons for that. And I suppose you just need to bear that in mind.
Well, and we should say, just in terms of getting a sense for how big the country is, for those who are coming from the States, if you picture the size of Texas, which is our largest state that is not Alaska, largest state in the lower 48, we're talking about a country that is about more than three times larger than that. And so that's why if there are problems in one part of Congo, of the DRC specifically, then it might still be safe to go to a different part. And so you just need to do your research and look into it as you do that. And it's going to be a changing situation. It is, they haven't had specifically something called a war in a few years, but they have had some conflicts, including some conflicts in Goma that have happened across the border as well. So something to look at. If you're listening to the show and it's been a few years, I would definitely do even more research because it will change over time. And, you know, honestly, we don't know what direction it'll change. But this did, one of the reasons I wanted to do this particular episode is we are talking about a pretty spectacular spot. And hopefully we're talking about a spectacular spot that will stabilize and get some good tourism revenue and support the economy there of the people of the DRC.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Anything else we want to cover before we get to a couple of our wrap-up questions?
No, I think that's mainly it. I think just maybe to mention to people, a lot of people might not travel all the way from the States just to do the DRC. So it's worth mentioning what kind of tags into it. So again, the only airline that flies directly into Goma is Ethiopian Airlines.
Okay.
So if you are visiting Ethiopia, it is actually an option to fly directly into Goma, and you can arrange with the park to collect you from there. Alternatively, an awful lot of people will do it with an actual more traditional safari. So either in Kenya would be quite a common link place, because you can fly from Nairobi to Kigali in Rwanda and travel. It's only a 3-hour drive to the border, and you can be within the park within kind of 4 or 5 hours of touching down. So that would be kind of the traditional add-ons for people who are doing maybe a 2-week or a bigger trip to Africa.
Good to know. And we have another show on the DRC, and we have shows on Uganda, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Kenya. I don't know if we have one on Burundi, which is the only other neighbor near there that you can check out. Answer this question for me. You were standing in the prettiest spot in the park, in Virunga National Park. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
I think it would have to be the crater lip of Nyiragongo. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, to make a slightly more interesting answer, though, supposedly, and I haven't tested all of this, I'd have to do a lot more traveling, but supposedly Nyiragongo has the most spectacular view from any toilet seat on Earth, which I can't say I'm an absolute expert on that, but it's a pretty spectacular view. So just down from the huts, maybe 5 or 6 meters down from the crater's edge, you have the toilet hut, which faces out back across, away from the volcano, out over the landscape, over the park, down on the city of Goma. And the toilet seat, there's no doors. So you do get quite spectacular view. Not for everyone, maybe, but definitely one for Instagram at some stage.
Well, that was an answer I wasn't expecting. And maybe we've already answered this. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Virunga National Park.
That is an interesting one. Although maybe to mix it up, I suppose, we'll go when we were on Chigera Island, we were right by boat. So there's a boat comes out and you landed on the island, and the manager wanted to introduce us to the island and said, we have this, and we have these otters and these birds. And at the end of it, just kind of almost as a throwaway comment, was, we have a single blue monkey. And you don't know quite how to react to the idea of this monkey and how he might have got there. But it was one of those, they brought 4 monkeys to the island and realized pretty quickly that monkeys eat a lot more than you might expect. And on a very small island, it's not going to work out very well. So they sent down people with tranquilizer guns to capture them humanely, bring them back to the park and give them more space to roam in. That worked fine for 3 of the normal monkeys. The 4th monkey was not cooperative and has managed still a year later to be on the run on the island. So I'm not sure there's too many kind of fancy resorts around the world that have a fugitive monkey kind of scampering around the place. But that was something that I wasn't expecting. I must say I had a good laugh when he occasionally used turn up to breakfast and steal our bananas.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Neil. And Neil, thank you so much. We don't have a website, as you say, so we won't send people to your best post on this particular area of the world. But thank you for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Virunga National Park and the DRC.
Absolutely, Chris. Thanks a million for having me.
I don't have any particular news here for the news of the community, so we're going to just end this episode. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.